So welcome to the Big Unlock podcast, David. We're really happy to have you here. And just to let you know, this is the 144th episode. It's been going on for a while and we're happy to continue the legacy that Paddy left behind. It's a really popular podcast and we've had, you know, cross-section of CIOs and guests here. So really looking forward to sharing the insights and hearing from you. My name is Ritu Oberoi and I'm a managing partner here at BigRio and Demo. And once again, welcome to the podcast. And you can start with your introduction, David. Thank you.
Well, thank you for having me, first and foremost. I must say, I started recently listening to the past episodes and seeing the incredible lineup of guests that have been on it. So my name is David Brenner. I'm Director of Clinical Informatics at the Crystal Clinic Orthopedic Center here in Akron, Ohio, the lovely home of LeBron James. I've been working for the Crystal Clinic for the past, I think I just celebrated my 15th year anniversary this year.
So tell us a little bit, David, about your journey, like how you, you know, came into healthcare and how you came to the Crystal Clinic and, you know, what has your experience been with, you know, how the healthcare field has evolved with, you know, digitization and the Affordable Care Act and how it's impacted your work? Where do you see it going now with the trends in generative AI? I know you wanted to talk about that, so we'll get there, but let's start with that.
So back when I was doing my first undergrad, I had a dream and a passion to get into healthcare, either be an anesthesiologist or a cardiologist. The rest of my family, almost the entire family, is involved in nursing. I forgot to go that route because it does open doors for many opportunities. So I got into nursing for two career paths. One was informatics, and the other was is nursing law. Okay. Well, the nursing law didn't pan out. And while I was sitting around basically doing nothing, I got a call from a friend of my wife's that was working with the Cleveland Clinic to implement their Epic system. It's been many years ago. Probably, was it 18 years ago? 16 years ago? It's been a while. And I jumped all over that because I figured this is an opportunity to get into the informatics. And from there, I helped roll out the EMR, order entry. I think I worked with the Children's Hospital, Tosse's Cancer Center, bringing up that module. And really, I fell into a niche of orthopedics and surgery. Surprisingly, out of the blue, I received a phone call from a Summa Health system, which Crystal Clinic used to partner with, about a clinical analyst position. I went in for an interview on Monday, which was February 22nd. Okay. And they actually wanted me to start the next day. I was hired on this, and I asked for, can I get one day to think about it? So I started working on a Wednesday, and by Thursday, I was knee deep, neck deep, however deep you want to say it, into programming the EHR, training the EHR, you name it. I was myself and one other person that was responsible. And at that time, we had a deadline to meet because Crystal Clinic Orthopedic Center is a physician-owned facility. So then that project in itself was, I believe, about 6 months behind when I came on board. And with the help of one of my other colleagues, we were able to turn that around in about 3 months. So we went live with our EHR, which was HMS at the time, and now is MedHost, in the middle of May. So that sort of started off my journey in sort of the informatics field. And from there, it was, I just, a few years, went into management, and then since 2016, I believe, and actually it's 2015, started working as director, and I've been holding that position ever since. When it comes sort of the promoting interoperability or meaningful use, that just, it allowed me to venture out more and learn more about healthcare. So it's been a challenge, especially with our organization, which I mean, given a full rundown of what Crystal Clinic is, we are a physician-owned hospital system. I always just call it a hospital, but it's a hospital system. If you really look at it, I mean, 16 clinic locations, which are outpatient clinics of the hospital. So we're governed by a joint commission in these areas, unlike a normal physician practice would be. We have our surgical hospital. We have an outpatient surgery center for orthopedic specific urgent care areas. I think we're, as of last Friday, I think we're at 51 positions. I mean, it's ever changing. Okay. We specialize in orthopedic and plastic reconstructive surgery, but we also have pain management underneath our umbrella. We're doing physical medicine and rehabilitation, sports medicine. And then we sort of round it off with 90 plus physical and occupational therapists. So we sort of see the gamut of all of orthopedic care. and really takes from end to end with that.
And is this all Ohio, David?
Or this is all in Ohio. And I don't know if I want to get into it now, but I might as well. It's sort of a good opening. We're actually just venturing out. Going to start this year with I'll call it travel medicine. In conjunction with telehealth, but being all the nice awards we have received, like ranked number one in Ohio and number top 1% in the U.S. with care checks analytics for orthopedic hospitals. We have 4 different certifications, Joint Commission certifications for disease specific measures, total knee, total hip, total shoulder and spine, which we're 1 of 3 in the nation with that. So we can do it better and we can do it cheaper. Mm-hmm. So that's sort of the beauty of what we do here at Crystal Clinic. And we decide to partner with local, and then now we're expanding out to regional and then national organizations. A lot of them are self-insured organizations that find it's cheaper to bring people in here as a destination than to have it done locally. I know the one surgery that they do sort of put at the top as an example, if you go to Texas and get a total ankle, you may be looking $300,000-$400,000 for a total ankle. We're less than half of that. And that includes travel, room and board, everything. And they're finding that with our outcomes, we can get them in quicker and we can get them back and healed quicker. And so the company itself is not losing that key individual in their organization. It's just something new we started. And I know it's catching on with Orthoforum and others are doing it, but it's a nice thing because patients are able to get their care they need and deserve quicker and get the outcomes that everybody wants. That's exciting news as we expand, I won't say globally, we'll say nationally, but still maintain our local presence. So just bring the people here. Instead of extending the resources to let's open a facility in Florida or Texas or wherever you have it, I don't think we can actually do for the cost of what we have here in Ohio, what we can do that anywhere else.
Yeah, that's a fairly interesting model that you outlined, because usually when people talk about this, they're looking to expand like in other locations rather than bringing people to your location. But I think that makes that digital health initiatives even more important than... How are you seeing your vision for doing this? Because then you have to be able to share everything back to the other hospital. And, have you had to rework your systems, or what do you think, what investments are you making to kind of make this possible for Crystal Clinic?
The nice thing is not expanding physically. I mean, you don't have a capital cost. So if you have a platform, I'll say like Zoom, well, you have it and you use it and it doesn't matter where you're at. It's the same thing here. We have some availability with some of the new providers we're bringing on board, and we have the capacity to bring within our schedules, both surgical and clinical, to fill them up. So we're not doing anything different than we would do if the person was local. We have a care coordinator, and there's sort of multiple ones, depends on the path that the patient may come to us. They sort of iron out all the details. They'll book the travel, they'll book the hotel stays, and we just focus on the patient and the healthcare that's provided.
I was asking more from the point of view of because the patient is not coming to you like pre-procedure. So, you have to get all their information into the system, make sure that all the pre-checks are done, maybe not locally. So how does that kind of impact your IT outlook, and, how do you take care of that in this model? It's just interesting.
Yeah. So we look at it. It's really through the care navigator. So we have a patient let's say in California, just can't work this pathway. We have a person who coordinates that ahead of time and gets a hold of us, and we sort of arrange things. But we have just recently rolled out online scheduling. I know we're probably a little behind compared to some of the larger organizations, but we, being a physician-owned, things are a little different. We take things a little slower, and we got to make sure we have physician buy-in too, because that's the last thing we want to do is throw something out there and it impacts the physician and they're not going to accept it. So really just throwing money away. So we started out with a few interested providers, baby steps along the way. Why don't you pilot this or look at this? And from there it was, okay, we went live with a beta test group.
Okay.
And within, I want to say a a few days, maybe up to a week, we've had over 100 people go online and schedule. It's just as some providers are seeing this and they're seeing their schedules get fuller, they're all for it. You still have some of those providers that are a little leery. They feel like they're losing control of their schedule, but we get the people in here and you look at the data that we're seeing of these people or these patients that when they schedule these appointments, it's the middle of the day, it's the middle of the night. It's off hours where you can't call in and just speak to our call center and schedule an appointment. So that's encouraging. We were missing those people before. So that's one of the ways that those who are not involved in a sort of a travel medicine pathway access our care. And that's something that we found out through multiple interviews of patients who didn't come here.
Yeah.
Or even of patients who just listening to them say, I wish you had this. Mm-hmm. And looking at the call data of, okay, we're dropping calls. Why are we dropping calls? And et cetera. We're finding out those numbers have actually declined as we opened this up.
So what were the major learnings? Like, what did you think that people, you know, the patients or the consumers are looking for today in the digital health experience? Or what insights did you get from that, which you then, you know, used to make the systems better and made it work?
That's a good question. I would probably say that we really weren't meeting the patients where they were at. We weren't providing the opportunity that newer generations, as we start taking care of more of millennials and Gen Z as they come on board, this is what they're asking for. This is what they want. And we were always stuck in the mindset of our core population is Medicare. It was probably a misnomer on our part of thinking we don't want to roll out too much technology because the older population may not have the technology. Well, coming to find out, that was I won't say a mistake, but it was something, a sort of misnomer on our part to think, well, no, almost everybody now has it or has a caregiver who has access to it.
Absolutely.
So that sort of was one of the driving factors and just listening to our patients and really reaching out and contacting those who, let's say, passed on scheduling or why they canceled or we never heard back. So, yes, we have to see a decline in cancellation rates in the short period of time we've done this because it's really, I won't say tailored medicine, but we are sort of tailoring to the experience that our patients are expecting now. And we have to evolve with that.
So this really leads in, you know, very nicely to the next question. And I think this is like a really valuable insight where you're saying that you can't just, and this is something we show in our generative AI workshop slides as well, that you need to have that, you know, small horizon. You can't wait for things to happen. And you can't push back and say, you know, that this group is not going to use the technology because it's coming. Like, you have to be ready for it. And that's how the, you know, similarly we feel about AI and generative AI, that, you know, every organization just needs to be able to at least know that it's out there and kind of see the use cases in their own organizations. So what are your feelings about that? Because I saw that one of the questions, you know, you sent for the AI said that just because we can doesn't mean we should. But right now, you just gave me an example where you said, you know, you had to get onto that technology bandwagon. So how do you feel about a similar thing, which is now applying to AI?
So our short-term initiative right now, and we're getting to the ambient generative AI.
Yes.
And we have physicians that are willing to, but we're taking our time. And that's what, I guess, start small and don't rush. Sort of like we did with the online scheduling. That was sort of one of the factors that we had to make sure we didn't do is rush through this and try to go big bang. Also, we had to make sure it works with our current EHR. What has been great for us and has worked over the multiple years I've been here is we were able to customize and program our EHR to our specific specialities, which I know a lot of large organizations, you try to, I don't say, put everybody in a mold. Well, we're trying to create that mold specific for our orthopedics and plastics and now pain and et cetera divisions, which is just basically a preformed or custom fabricated splint. So that's where we're treating this. So yeah, so the nice thing with the company that we're sort of doing a pilot with, and I don't want to say them out loud, so we haven't really signed a contract yet, does work really well and sort of puts the output of the AMBA AI into specific we'll call it observation terms, or fields in our EHR. So it's just another means of getting the data into our EHR and our custom programming.
Okay. So this is during the patient consultation?
This is during the patient's in here. And as they're speaking, just like all the other ambient AIs, it does create a note, but then it sort of segments them off into different areas because this is the HPI. So we're going to put this in the HPI section. Here's their health history for surgery goes and past medical problems. We'll move that into this section, some of the other social fields. And then, of course, the assessment and plan, those are going to its own section. So it's sort of taking that ambient AI generated text, and then we on the back end are assigning it as they send it to us to a specific field. So it's almost like having a scribe sitting there typing this into the, but it's just sitting there ambiently and doing it. And what's nice about what we have in our current system, which is Athena Practice, it's all structured data. So if we want to report on this, I could throw into a SQL query and pull all out. Well, that's the beauty of it. Instead of just having a note that a searchable PDF or what have you, you could, it's still sort of structured data. You can still find information, but to really extract it out and run analytics on it. Right. That's where we're at now and what we're looking forward to. It's a nice, easy transition. I do know some of the providers who are using Scribes are excited about it. One, because the Scribes is not a permanent role. It's sort of a transitional role. I just graduated undergrad. I'm waiting to see if I get into med school, and they're taking this role and they want to get into orthopedics and just looks good on their resume. And then you don't have, well, this came up or I'm sick and they call off and now I have nobody. So this is sort of a nicety and replacing a human being in the room and listening and doing all the describing for the provider. So I think they're excited. They see how it works. And with the company we're going with, they've been known to be able to control the EHR via voice as well. Okay. So it's a nice blend of the two.
Okay. So when, you know, we did our Chime focus group and we found that this was one area where, you know, a lot of work was happening. In fact, in our, you know, generative AI workshops, we showed this as like one of the success stories with the ambient listening. But the Chime survey showed that people still want human in the loop. So how does that work here? The physicians still need to review like everything that's been done by the scribe and then they click like an approve button, or does it just go in there and then, you know, how are you guys handling that?
They do have to approve it. So nothing is final. Even with, we actually had a physical scribe in the room with the providers, it still was, I had to go in and I had to attest and
exactly
to what was actually in the documentation. And you look at the rules and regulations, especially specifically in Ohio, but some national as well, a scribe can't order. So a physician still has to go in there. They still have to sign off on the documentation. They still have to enter the orders they need to be entered and sign off on those as well. So there is that piece in at the end of it. And I know this was a huge thing too with our HIM department as we're bringing on AI here is, how do you fix anomalies? Granted, I mean, if you look at a dictation system where you can flag anomalies, it's a little easier there, but here it's real time and AI has come a long ways beyond sort of a transcription service to not have such anomalies in there. So that is one of the caveats and one of the requirements. You must sign off on it. And over the years, I mean, we haven't seen it yet, but it's going to happen. And it's just, I'll say human nature. I'm catching a provider or whoever may be using this at a certain time in their attire, and they take a glance over it. Yeah, it looks correct, and they approve it. And there was an anomaly in that. So I mean, it's no different. It's just a different means of getting the information in there. But at the end, the provider is still signing off on the document. So it is there. It's no matter how the information got in there. Their expectation is, and the governance here is, you read it, you agree with it, and you're signing your credentials to it. So it's your documentation, no matter how it got in there.
But do you think the physicians, like this leads directly to, you know, the next topic that you had outlined for AI, which is, you know, is AI leading to the death of critical thinking?
Yeah.
It's very interesting because I was talking to my cousin who's a physician and she was saying that, you know, if everything is being pre-filled for you and, you know, you're like we see now, you know, we have a client and they've used LLMs to generate care plans for patients. And they've taken, the nurses go mainly into review mode once again as human in the loop and see like a, completely prepared care plan and then just sign off on it if it's okay. So how do you think, where do you think, this is more like a philosophical question, but how do you feel about the role of humans here? Or if they're doing everything for you and you're just reviewing, then aren't you losing your core skills that you spent so many years being trained for? And
so the NVIDIA AI depends on how we structure it. Our current setup that we're going for, I'm going to say no. Because at the end here with this particular setup, yeah, we're having that conversation with the patient. We're going through all the examinations and then we're verbally having this. And we don't have currently, don't have any some of that clinical decision support. And that's where I think the gray line is. And we're, it's a slippery slope. Once you get into the clinical decision support, that's thinking. Mm-hmm. And I've seen it in the 20 years or so I've been in healthcare, and I had the privilege of being in healthcare when it was all handwritten and as it transferred to an electronic. As
digitization.
Yeah. Nurses in particular, being a nurse, they've lost the skill one how to sign their name.
That's exactly what I'm talking about.
And now you take it a step further and you get some of these nurses who have never been on paper. And I hear it time and time again is the system didn't tell me to insert whatever. Well, no, you should, as a nurse, and you should be able to do a head to toe assessment and do that critical thinking. In that, the one example I had back when I was a nurse is a patient of mine, a stroke patient. If you look at all the tests I would perform on them to see where they are cognitively, they passed. They're fine. So they knew where they're at, what's going on, the president, the three-word repeat test, the Apple penny table. So everything I did on this patient passed. But there was one phrase that they said is to make sure their loved one knew they're okay. And they thought that person was in the basement of their house, which was the floor below their room in the hospital. So that was just sort of off. This is not something I don't think AI, even AMI AI, if you put it in place, would pick up. Mm-hmm. It probably would ignore that because it has not as irrelevant to do with the care of the patient. So that's what sort of means, I think, the death of critical thinking. If I alerted our attending that night, and it wasn't normal from a nursing standpoint, but from a physician standpoint, where that stroke was, you will see some of this residual effect. Unfortunately, I had another patient that was crashing, and I was attending to that one, and the patient who had the stroke actually had a large hemorrhage. So the outcome was not the best, unfavorable outcome. But if we start putting AI into places where, hey, we can put it here, I say just because we can doesn't mean we should. But yeah, we could put NVIDIA AI, we could have all this documentation done. It's those little pieces of critical thinking that we don't want to lose. And that's my fear. If we do that, then the next one is, well, I didn't start with, well, the system didn't tell me to.
Right.
Then it's like, well, it could be anything. Well, the system didn't tell me they were on this medication. Well, no, the system doesn't need to tell you you're on that medication. You need to look before you do something. So there's, like I said, it's a slippery slope once you start putting the AI into the healthcare and the documentation, the system, that at what point in time do we lose all these critical thinking skills?
Yeah, that's a really interesting point of discussion because, now you hear that it can ace all the medical exams, it can learn everything. You have these AI companions who are being, trained for mental health, but then it's paradoxical because the mental health, the main problem is loneliness. And if you're substituting it with a computer who doesn't really have feelings, but can talk to you like it does, then, it's an interesting paradox. So we have to wait and see where this, all this technology is going to take us. But it's good to be cognizant of the pitfalls and know what the limitations are and, what to watch out for.
Yeah, and that's why we want to take it slow. We know it's there. Mm-hmm. We don't need to rush into it. We're not being forced to yet.
Sure. Because you're in, and you're dealing with the patients and because you have this really interesting background of having come from nursing yourself, which, was a really good motivational story that I heard from you. Because I think whenever we talk to people in healthcare, almost everyone has like a special story of how they got here and what made them come into healthcare. So what do you think for AI from your perspective and within your organization, like very specifically is what I'm trying to ask, not, you know, generally, what do you think could be like a good use case or where it would, you know, directly benefit your patients and would be like a real win for your organization? Like if you had to do it, what field would you pick or where do you think this implementation could be?
At least for orthopedics, I would say the one area that we could potentially use this for a case win, and it's probably in radiology or all the imaging stuff. That's been a huge topic out there on how if you have AI that looks at your, we'll call them films, it's all digital films now, but looks at them and does a report and the findings. And of course, you have a radiologist sign off on that, agreeing with that. No, we have not put that in place yet, but I do feel that that would be a huge win for us. One, it's be more accurate in what we're finding and really fine-tuning what needs to be done. The other one is from our surgeon's perspective, and we do have radiologists read off all of our x-rays too, does a backup, a secondary read of it. The orthopedic, you may have something that an anomaly may appear on the pictures, but they're not trained and, I mean, have been looking at bones all this time. Well, now you have an anomaly that shows up and it's like, oh, it may be odd or it just doesn't seem right. They're still held responsible for it if it shows up in the image. But if you have an AI layer on top of that, well, now it's, hey, this may be a tumor, this may be whatever it is. Well, we probably should send this on to somebody else. So I can see that being ortho-specific really and helping us to really take better care of our patients. So more and more things are creeped up in patients and it's the more holistic care I think we can provide, even though we're not doing the treatment of something that may appear, but we can refer them and make sure that we follow up and the patient is well taken care of from that standpoint. I did have another use case that I haven't seen yet, but I haven't been looking for it yet either, is we do a little bit of custom implants. So we do have a program that depends on, could be MRI, could be a CT, that really does create a custom implant for our patients. I see that getting better and be more precise. Because right now, my mother is a good example. She had her knee replaced this year and she had a CT done and they sent it off to the vendor and looking at all the physiological and the anatomy of specific for my mother, here is a custom implant for you that's designed to fit you. But it's no longer, back when I started nursing, it was, okay, we'll try this one. And okay, that doesn't fit. Let's tweak it a little bit. Let's do this. And it's just a lot of construction now. So it's almost like plug and play. So that one, I think we can start seeing an increase in AI usage there. So everything's tailored to each patient and their anatomy.
Personalized. I think those were very good examples, David. Thank you for sharing them with us. And you know, for the radiology one, I have like a really interesting story because I was doing this generative AI program at the Harvard, Chan School of Medicine. And they gave this example. So one of the participants in that class was the head of NHS from England. And she talked about, you know, how in England, the requirement is that every radiology report has to have two radiologists sign off on it. So one generates the report and then the other radiologist has to review everything and make sure that nothing got missed. And she said it was leading to like huge backlogs in the system and people had to wait for the reports for a long time because just to get like two radiologists. So, you know, one prime example of AI that they found right there was like, let AI be one of the doctors and do like a radiology scan. And then the other radiologist actually reviews it and signs off on it. And it was like a huge win for them and led to, you know, significant reduction in the wait times for people to get their reports. So that was very interesting what you talked about radiology. And I think that's like a really good use case.
Agree. I think I've heard that. That's sort of the same story coming out of the New England there, or the England, UK. So.
And the other one is also like a really good implementation of the custom implants and personalized medicine, because again, AI, like they say, you know, if you have a fever, they say take Tylenol, but the Tylenol is geared towards like a very specific median weight or, you know, might not exactly be the dosage you need for your body. But with AI, it can exactly tell you, like if I'm talking about digital twins, I don't know if you heard that. Yeah. So if you have a digital twin, they can exactly tailor it and then see what would work on the twin and then see what would work in real life. So these are all really, you know, cool and interesting examples. I think that leads us nicely into our next topic of, you know, AI governance. And what do you feel about, like, so I've heard pros and cons about this as well, you know, like within your organization, where do you see the role of like a chief AI officer? And that has pros and cons, because some people say that, you know, again, AI, the use cases encompass so many different departments that you can't, if you have like a specific AI officer, you're almost kind of limiting it and saying that this person is taking care of it, whereas it should be like enterprise wide. So what are your feelings about that? And do you think your organization is implementing or hiring like a chief AI officer or having like an AI department, or is it just spread across different departments? Like everybody's kind of doing something and then.
So, I mean, the way our system is set up and organizational, we're a small organization with big problems. So we limited our chiefs, I won't say to four. I haven't seen more than four.
Okay.
In the time I've been here, and they wear multiple hats. So I don't foresee a chief AI officer. And I said the good and bad, like you said, every department's going to have a need or maybe a want that's very unique to them with AI. A lot of it comes back to, it's all IT, however you look at it. So that's how we spread it here. It all comes back to the IT department. We may not govern the usage of it, but we will support it and should be involved in it. We do have a physician. Well, we just started this, so I would say a physician director for IT. So he's it's a role that we interact with from the IT department to make sure that we're meeting the needs of the providers, we're meeting the needs of the patients, we're being safe, communications is appropriate for any changes to the system. So he's sort of going to be that liaison and making sure that from a medical standpoint, sort of acting like a CMIO, but not having the title, but sort of being that person. I don't see, like I said, I don't see a CAI involved since we're so little early on in our journey with AI. I can't say no. Maybe a CIO oversee that, or maybe a chief informatics officer. It depends on how we want to really broad and expand our chief level staff. But yeah, I say I don't see it being governed by one person. It's going to have to be a collective, because AI, like I said, touches all departments, and we got to make sure that we're, I could probably see a committee governing that. So to make sure that, yeah, AI is perfect here, but fiscally irresponsible. We can't spend that much money for one thing because our ROI on it's not there. Or we want to do this great thing. Yeah, but just because we can doesn't mean we should do it. Right. So sort of bring it to that, the one topic I wanted to discuss there.
So do you have that committee in place?
We don't have an AI committee in place yet. But we do have the technology committee, I guess you'd call it, that looks at all these areas.
Okay. So what do you think is your timeline for, you know, like, are you thinking of implementing this in the next 6 to 9 months or maybe like a year?
For me personally, it has to be the next 6 to 9 months. And part of that committee, once formed, is definitely we have to educate people. And that's the biggest thing I'm finding in our organization and all of these conferences I'm going to and people I speak with. When you say AI, everybody thinks ChatGPT.
Yes.
It goes beyond ChatGPT. I know we started writing AI policies and we're really being vague with the first AI policy is it must be approved and go through these steps before we can start implementing it. But it started out as a blanket AI policy. And it's like, well, wait a minute. Back when we started programming our EHR in 2012, I think, we sort of did AI there. You might not think it, but you look at how we programmed it, there is AI involved. Granted, the algorithms and what we use are extremely small and not really large, but it was, we took point and clicks and we created a narrative from that point and click based on everything, that all the data was being fed into it. So that is definitely on my radar to make sure that we need to educate. I know one of the workshops this year in the spring that was at, someone mentioned the difference between people who have a job in the future and those who don't are those who are AI enlightened.
Yes, exactly. It's an augmentation.
You got to be educated and you have to have a familiarity. You don't need to know LLMs and everything else that goes along with AI and how it's all there, but you need to be aware of it. And we need to educate the end users not to be afraid of it, of replacing you. It's going to help you do your job better and be more efficient.
It's a power tool, and it should be in your vocabulary, and you should be able to have that conversation. That's how we pitch it, you know.
And you should apply it to the right areas too. I mean, do the ROI on it. See how much time is being invested. And just project management is another one that I'm passionate about, that there's a lot of stuff where AI can really help out there. And just doing the mundane task and helping up with the communication plan, making sure everybody has all the information and it's nicely tailored and it looks pretty. And the project manager didn't have to spend the time to go through and redo all the stuff and make sure the system does it for you. Let the system work for you where it can, but still have the checks and balances in place that need to be there so it can be, the anomalies can be addressed.
Yeah, we've seen a very good implementation of that with our client Vivid, like I was telling you about. They've been able to generate these, you know, comprehensive care plans. And, you know, then it goes into the nurse's admin panel. And then only once they hit publish, it goes out. Mm-hmm. And that's the beauty of it. It can read and scan like a lot more data and understand and remember everything. And especially for people with like multiple chronic conditions, and come up with quite a comprehensive care plan. So I think they've launched it in a couple of hospitals already, and they've seen really good, you know, feedback. But like you said, it's all evolving and it's very new. So we have to kind of wait and watch and see where it takes us.
And that's, I just had a recent conversation beginning of last month, I believe. Actually, it was the day I came back from holiday and I had a broken car in the middle of the highway. So I was doing a Zoom call with this woman, and it was talking about AI education. And the fact that a lot of universities, like a lot of healthcare systems, are struggling with budgets, but they know they had to have something AI related. So they're reaching out to organizations that create education and do the master certificates and some of the courses. And because they have to be competitive, otherwise they'll go to the wayside, and I'm going to choose this organization or this college and university because they have an AI program and this one does not.
Exactly. You fall behind. That's exactly what I was saying. It's not a choice.
But it's so rapidly changing that the universities do not have the financial backing or the budget to keep up with it. So that's where I know they're working in conjunction with some of these companies that create just specific AI education and go through the courses, which it is what it is. I mean, it's ideally be nice to be able to have the universities do it all, but.
Yeah. No, it's not just that, David. It's also, you know, AI and education is really a hot button topic right now, just because all the conventional, you know, assignments that the teachers used to give with generative AI, you can easily ask ChatGPT to write it for you. And the amazing thing is that even ChatGPT itself cannot distinguish between AI generated content or human content. So they're saying the role of teaching.
Yeah. That's the one thing that concerns me too. And I just read an article, and I wish I remember the name of the article, the title of it. But in the future, and it may not be so much for healthcare, because healthcare is very specific to the patient and to each episode of care, but AI in general, what you're training the AI systems on is AI generated data.
Exactly.
So now we'll have a plateau. Mm-hmm. And it's all going to be all look the same. It's all going to be the same. It's going to be so like monotone.
Yes. Uh-huh. This was a New York Times article that was talking about synthetic data. I read it too. And we've incorporated into our workshop for the next, you know, because it's really interesting, because Sam Altman said that billions of pieces of data are being generated every day. And exactly like what you said, you know, these bots are crawling the web looking for new content to read and ingest. And they can't tell the difference whether this is human generated. So they're reading their own content and building up on it. And once you go through, you know, several generations of this, then like you said, it all starts evening out and becoming monotonic, because a lot of the content that the bots generate is very, it's impersonal. Mm-hmm. You can't add those little human stories, and like you gave the story about the patient, you know, that's not going to be there in a ChatGPT generated content. So everything starts becoming very vanilla and, you know, indistinguishable from each other. So that's like a big pitfall right now, because they've kind of run out of human generated data. They've already read all of Reddit, all of you know, everything. So now they're going to this generated data, and that's going to show up as a huge problem. Even for image generation, it's so crazy, you know. I was seeing an example, maybe in the same article or a different article, where all the faces of the people start looking alike after like 10 generations of that, of it reading its own content, because all the differences and the diversity starts getting wiped out and everything's just the same. So definitely a lot of concerns that need to be addressed, and you know, a lot of regulations that need to be put into place. But yeah, those are topics for another podcast, I think.
Yeah. I know the one other thing too that I'm finding interesting is realistic expectations. So I had a recent conversation a couple of weeks ago with a company that really niched their AI for social determinants of health, because perfection is what they're going for. They're going for 100%. Hey, we take all this, ingest all this data, and here is, without a doubt, 100%, this patient's going to be a no-show for their next visit. But they're finding out, depending on the timing of when that data is ingested or documented, and when the algorithm with AIs ran, it's only good at that particular time. So they didn't want to sell something that maybe said was 75% accurate, because whatever happens after that initial visit, and I mean, a life-changing event, person loses their job, or they lose a spouse or a family member, or something drastically happens. Well, you don't have that collected in your AI data, because it happened outside and past when that algorithm was ran. So they were trying to get all this together and really produce a very high percentage accuracy. Yeah. And they couldn't live with the fact that it can't be 100%, but they couldn't even get to like 90%. It's like, because all the external factors, and then garbage in, garbage out too. You have to document appropriately. So yeah.
That's a tough problem to solve. The no-shows, you know, that's like a huge, like you said, there's so many variables and so many factors. And in fact, we show that as one of our, you know, case studies of where things could go wrong, because those no-shows are really biased towards people who already have problems. That's why they don't show up, you know?
Yeah.
Like maybe they don't have somebody to look after their kids or something. And then when you build these algorithms, it kind of reinforces that and makes it worse for those people. So actually, it's a very difficult problem to solve.
Yeah. And then you take that data and have an insurance company use that data that was designed specifically for a certain area, but we're going to apply it to this, which, well, it wasn't designed for that. It doesn't really support the decisions you're making. Yeah. So it can be a good thing and a bad thing. And that's what I'm sort of sitting on the fringes waiting to say, where are we going with this? And what's, it's truly going to be 100% yet we're going this way. Other one is, this is, we're sort of creeping around the corner here. And it's like, I'm not quite sure if that's the way we should go, or maybe we should just wait and see what other people do, learn from their mistakes.
That's the problem with Pandora's box. Once you open it, then, you know.
Exactly.
As
soon as we're in the thick of it, we just keep going.
Yep, exactly. So thank you, David. It's been great having this conversation. And, you know, any last thoughts before we conclude?
Not really. I mean, I'm just excited about where AI is taking us. I'm excited about what Big Rio and Demo's doing with things. I'm excited where this podcast has gone and it's going. And I thank you for just having me on and allowing me to share my story, my experience, and hopefully it does benefit others out there.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for coming on to the podcast and sharing all your stories. Thank you, David.
Thank you very much.